Good afternoon and welcome to your own health and fitness talk show. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I'm here live with you every Tuesday at 2, talking to you about health care and fitness and taking your phone calls. Today, as promised, is one of my monthly solo shows, and today I'll be talking to you about how to protect yourself from developing chronic illnesses. I'll be opening up the phone lines for your participation, as I usually do, somewhere around 2:40. And that number, whether you're here in the Bay Area or in Southern California, is 510-848-4425. And I'll give out the number right before I open up the phone lines. A reminder, if you miss parts of the show or if you'd like to get a cassette copy of today's show, you can reach me or you can call me if you need to reach me at 707-769-1458. I'll give that number out again later, and please call during normal business hours. I chose this topic for the show partially because I received a phone call from somebody that was rather compelling, and it made me want to do the show. She was calling to see whether I could give her snippets of research to use as ammunition when people began to talk to her about how illness is caused by people's psychology being awry or by people being invested in wanting to be sick. And that, in other words, this idea of blaming the victim. And it happens at a very subtle level with people. When people do that, what I suspect is happening is that being close to someone who is ill, particularly if the illness is not something very clear, you know, as terrible as it is to get a critical diagnosis, people usually don't doubt that somebody really has cancer, but if somebody has something more amorphous that sort of drags on and is chronic and they're not familiar with, sometimes there's some distrust of the situation. People sometimes think people who are ill like this have some depression or something. Although, in fact, when people are diagnosed with cancer, a lot of times people, without realizing that they're doing it, say things like, well, how did you eat? You know, did you handle stress well? Yeah. And my suspicion is that part of the reason this happens is because it is very scary to imagine that such a thing could happen to you. And I think that it's disturbing to people to think that you can't control everything that happens. Last week, we did a show about ovarian cancer, and Dr. David Miner, who was with us, who's the director of oncology for inpatient services at California Pacific, when I asked him if there was a cancer personality, what he reminded us was about the fact that when he went back in medical history books, they used to talk during the time when there's a lot of pneumonia and consumption, they used to talk about whether or not there was a pneumonia personality, you know, or a tuberculin type of personality or something. So this concept that certain people will be predisposed to these things, particularly before we understand the root of illness or of any particular illness, is a natural reaction. And I think that part of it is because it's very hard for people to contain the gravity of somebody being ill and not being able to help them, or the possibility that such a thing could happen out of the blue to an individual. Well, you know, I think there's a number of things that can contribute, and I would never suggest that the body and mind could be peeled apart. They're very integrated, and I would never suggest that the mind is not involved in illness, but the way in which it's involved, the degree to which it's involved, and how it feeds back on itself, the mind and the body feed back, it isn't, in other words, what I'm trying to suggest is that it isn't a situation where you can literally peel this apart. And in a way, when you say that somebody is responsible for their illness, in a way, you are peeling the two things apart. In a funny kind of way, you are saying the mind and body are separated. And I would like today to explore some of the things that can contribute to the development of a chronic illness. And I would also like to try to go through some of the, as I promised last week, some of the vitamin therapy research that's been done around cancer treatment, protection against cancer, and also things that can be used to support people if they do decide to go through chemotherapy. But I wanted to start out by sort of examining the cascade of events that may occur that can end up with somebody being chronically ill. One of the things that we've learned from from the research, the wonderful research that was done by Robert Sapolsky from Stanford University. He's the one who did all the research on stress. If we go back and we start to talk about genetics, whether or not genetics is part of what may predispose people to become ill, how does that fit in? How does genetics fit in? Some people, you know, incidentally, do everything right, and they still get sick. They lead happy lives. They lead involved lives. They feel good during their lives, and they still get sick. So what if genetics had a role? How would that work? What I'd like to suggest is that when people come from a genetic line, the role of trauma may exist depending on your ancestral background. So stress is, if there's trauma in your history, not just your immediate history, but your ancestral history, it may have an effect on your genetics. What happens with stress, as we learned from Robert Sapolsky, is that it's not only expensive to the body's capacity to balance itself, and we all know that balance is critical for health, but the glucocorticoid steroids that are produced when the body is subjected to sort of chronic stress damage the organs by restricting blood flow. Blood is at this point, when you're under chronic stress, is going to your large muscles to help you to get out of the situation, because your body honestly doesn't really understand the difference between stress that's caused by an immediate danger, somebody standing in front of you with a gun or an animal chasing you, and the sort of stress that you experience in a prolonged meeting or an argument or in traffic. Your body doesn't respond differently to stress, it responds the same way, and it understands stress as a signal. Your body begins to get you ready to get out of there or to fight. So what happens, as I said, is that it sends blood to your muscles to make it possible for you to go to get away from the situation. Also, what happens in this type of situation under chronic stress is that your body damps down the usual sorts of things that it does that are part of natural life. For instance, it diminishes, under stress, it diminishes hormone production, because why should you reproduce if the most important thing right now is to survive? So if you're under sort of chronic stress, your hormonal production will go down. And this is true in men and women. So when men are concerned about impotence, for instance, we just learned that men are buying when men are having trouble with sexual performance, they're buying a lot of these drugs right now. There's this incredible popularity for impotence drugs. And one of the things that you need to look at when you're facing a situation like that is whether or not you're under stress, because on a very practical level, despite the fact that your mind may not be in the mood, your body's not going to be in the mood, because under stress, it's diminishing hormone production. This type of accumulated damage, including damage from things like chemical pollution and radiation damages, it damages the DNA, it damages our genetic material, and that means that these changes get passed on from generation to generation. So what if your ancestors withstood terrible hardships? How much did the stress of their lives change the capacity of their bodies to produce, say, for instance, happy chemicals in the brain, like serotonin or endorphins? How much did they suffer famine that made their bodies adapt by becoming very efficient at making do with very little? We learned from researchers who are doing work on addiction, people like Joan Matthews Larson, that ethnic groups, like Native Americans, for instance, other Native groups, are very susceptible to addiction because their efficient bodies react very strongly to alcohol and sugar. They become addicted more easily. And we've gone over this in past shows, but what spins out from that cascade is insulin resistance from an addiction to sugar, which causes many groups to develop weight problems, food addictions, and allergies, and the accompanying problems of diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart disease. So how much is what's going on with an individual genetic, and how much is a result of your lifestyle? Well, let's look at a possible formula. Let's write this out as if we were doing a mathematical formula. First, we write genetics, and then we can put equals no happy chemicals. Let's say you came from a group where your ancestors had adapted down to deal with difficult situations, so they didn't have extra happy chemicals. This might lead to a state of sort of susceptibility to anxiety and sleeplessness, and a tendency to overwork and maybe overexercise. And that might lead to fatigue. And that might lead, these are like with little equal marks, to self-medication, maybe with drugs or alcohol or sweets, which equals insulin resistance, adrenal exhaustion. And that leads on to maybe no hormones. And that leads on to heart problems and other chronic health problems. So when someone begins to think about whether or not a person with a kind of ongoing low level or even a serious chronic illness or a terminal illness, how much is it their fault if you're dealing with a historical accumulation of DNA changes throughout your ancestors? Is that someone's fault? And indeed, when people begin to develop sort of perverse lifestyles, some of what's going on is that people are attempting to take care of themselves the only way that they know how. It may not be an informed way to take care of yourself, but when someone is abusing a substance, for instance, they're doing it in order to feel better. So it's a good thing to remember when you're blaming somebody for getting sick that maybe they don't have good control over the situation, and maybe they don't have enough information. So then, what do you do in this kind of situation? How do you put a stick in this wheel to stop this sort of rolling cascade? What do you do? Well, the first thing to do, I think, in my opinion, is that you look at family history. And then numerous researchers, I'm not the only one that has this opinion, numerous researchers have suggested that it's a good idea to then go back and look at allergies and addictions and whether they run in the family. Then you obviously, because you're looking at allergies and addictions, you're going to want to support and repair the gut, the whole, your digestive system, your GI system, your intestinal system, and how that functions, and whether or not the mucosa is healthy, and whether or not you're absorbing your nutrients, whether or not you're undernourished because of absorption problems. In fact, because of all of this, you then want to also rule out hormonal disruptions, because as we learned, sometimes the sex hormones are going to be affected by family history, or even you can have hormonal disruptions occur genetically in a family, for instance, because of maybe radiation damage. My parents' generation were exposed to more radiation than my generation. If you coughed, they gave you a chest x-ray. Well, this damages the thyroid gland. And the damage to the thyroid gland, the tissue of the thyroid gland, that damage is genetically inherited by the next generation. The stress hormones. What about chronic stress? What about the way we've speeded up our world? Some people, as we've learned from what I've been talking about and from the researchers that I've interviewed on the show, we've learned that this type of stress is maladaptive, and that the body, in its attempt to maintain balance, makes adaptive changes which cause problems in other areas, other organ systems. And stress hormones do damage other parts of the body if they're not balanced properly, if there's not a balance restorative quality to their lives. So what do you do to restore? What if you are under stress? What if that's inevitable? What if you are by nature a rather high-strung person who tends to worry, and you know that you shouldn't worry and you don't want to self-medicate? Well, then you look at supplements and diet. You look at how you're eating and how you're supplementing your body, because maybe there is some lack of nutritional effect because of gut function. And you also want to look at ways in which to take breaks. You want to balance movement or exercise, and you want to find a pattern that fits who you actually are and how you want your system to function. And an exercise program should address your hormones, whether or not you have insulin resistance. But it will also repair some of these problems. Adding muscle to your body means that you're adding more hormonal structures. You have more your hormones are stored in your muscle tissue. Insulin resistance will be alleviated because your blood sugar will go down when you exercise. It increases circulation, which protects you from a whole assortment of diseases, including cancer in some ways. Not that people who exercise don't get cancer, but that increased circulation. And then you're making happy chemicals when you exercise. But if you don't balance exercise with rest and emotional breaks, you're not going to be able to maintain happy chemicals. You'll get yourself into a loop where you're in an addictive cycle again. So to support the exercise, you will need sufficient rest. And to support your body under stress, you'll need sufficient rest and emotional breaks. And that will help with the production of the good chemicals in your brain. And it also allows, as I said, your body to adapt to stress, to repair itself, and also it gives you a chance to figure out what you want to do and to examine what's going on with yourself, to have a sense of what to do and who you are and what you're feeling and what's going on. It's one of the reasons people don't rest is because they don't want to know what's going on. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman. I'm doing a show that I'm attempting to give people some sense of how to protect themselves from the occurrence or the development of chronic illness. Not that we have ultimate control, but just examining what sorts of things happen that contribute to this. Another thing that I've been thinking about is that I was speaking to a woman I work with who is a hospice nurse. And I asked her what she learned from working with the dying. And what she said was, this is as good as it gets. She said, people, when they get a critical diagnosis, suddenly begin to do art therapy, to get massages. She said, don't wait for a critical diagnosis. Get a massage now. People often find that being stopped by an illness can be a blessing. They feel like it sort of pulls them up short in the midst of their lives and reminds them of the value of life. I don't know why we insist on not appreciating things until they're gone, but it seems to be part of human nature that we kind of get on a roll. But there are many people who live with degrees of chronic illness that degrade their capacity for joy and their sense of aliveness. Based on my experience working with individuals, I'd like to recommend to people who are close to people like this that you remember that the causes of illness are often very old and they're not turned around quickly, and that some things are actually out of our control. So even if the cause of the illness is some perverse behavior or what appears to be perverse, even though what I've mentioned to you is that in many cases, people are attempting to take care of themselves in the only way they know. Even if their behavior seems perverse, unwinding the causes is something that will take a long time and may not be unwound in the course of one lifetime. It's just, you know, it's like everything else in life. It's a work in progress. So learning to live in your actual skin is pretty much of a challenge, and it's potentially a path. Sometimes it's just bad luck. So one of the things that, of course, again, when we talk about this issue of whether or not the body and the mind can be separated out, one of the things that I'm trying to say here is that the most important thing people can do, I think, to support health is to give themselves some time out so that you can begin to review how you are and what's going on and begin to have some access to what's going on in your inner world, because that will inform you. You'll feel drawn or not drawn. Even if part of what you're dealing with is sort of really, really invasive stress in your life and you feel trapped, we know that one of the most profoundly debilitating things that's associated with stress is feeling trapped, feeling that you don't have a choice, feeling that you can't make a decision or have some input into what happens to you. This type of stress is very debilitating. It's kind of something we call learned helplessness in scientific studies. As far back as the 40s, Hans Selye was doing studies into this. Well, what that means is that if you are in a situation where you're supporting a family and, you know, it's not like you have a lot of choices, one of the things that may be important to do is to relax and unwind your situation and notice what sorts of choices you've made. Because even knowing that you've made choices will reduce the stress. So taking time out, using a combination of therapies to take care of yourself, not just using exercise or this or health things or getting a massage, but including time out so that you have some conversation with yourself, and maybe even using some psychological counseling just so that you have a safe place to explore your inner world so that you can have the fullness of who you are, because it is the case that that's the way that we've observed people get better, is when they have access to a sense of what they need. This said, bad things still happen to people, and you know, there's no ultimate protection, but you can participate. And what we learned in the last few shows is that people, when they become critically ill, sometimes still have some sense of something very sweet and very special that occurs to them if they stay present in the process that they're going through instead of running away, and if they get support for that. I want to move on to, and I'll start going over this, and then we'll take a brief musical break and I'll finish it, but I promised that I would talk about the types of nutrient therapy that have been shown through research to have some protective effects on the development of cancerous tumors. So there are basically four things that you want to address when you're thinking about tumors and preventing tumors from growing. The first thing is antioxidant therapy, because antioxidants protect the DNA, our genetic material, from damage. Antioxidants also increase cellular energy, which is terribly important. Now, we all know A, E, and C are antioxidants, but specifically vitamin E and coenzyme Q10 and lipoic acid are very effective because they go right into the cell. The mitochondria is our little energy cells, and they are way deep inside the cell, and these particular substances will go right into the cell. Vitamin C doesn't get past the cell wall, but in research that's been done forever, high doses of vitamin C has been shown to inhibit tumor cells. I don't care what you saw in the Chronicle or in the Associated Press recently or wherever you are, or the LA Times. Most of the research that's been done indicates over and over again that high doses of vitamin C has been shown to inhibit tumor cells. It does a number of other things for other chronic illnesses. It lowers cholesterol. It does so many things. But also remember that nutrient therapy never works alone. So if you take one thing like vitamin C and you test it by itself, they don't work by themselves. They work in an orchestra. They work as instruments in an orchestra. So you don't just take one substance. In fact, there was a research project that was done that indicates that if you only take one or two, this was in China, they did studies, the Journal of Cancer 1983 Institute. If you only take one or two of these substances, it may even be harmful in high-risk groups. So you always want to take the multi thing. And so in this case, what they did is they even used a very weak multivitamin and found that to be very powerful in reducing cancer. But you can do better, is what I'm saying, but never just one or two. Reducing inflammation is very important. And fatty acids, you know, the omega fatty acids, omega-3s, are even more powerful than drug therapy for reducing inflammation. Thing to remember is that if you take omega-3s, like the fish oils, omega-3s, you must balance them with some gamma-linoleic acid and some omega-6s. Otherwise, you tend to get dry. Your skin, your hair gets dry. So you need a balance. They function in a balanced situation. You need to control allergies, and this is true in all chronic illness. Lowering histamine production, quercetin, which is a bioflavonoid, and again, bioflavonoids and vitamin C are synergistic. Antihistamine quercetin, the bioflavonoid, is a good way of reducing histamine. Also, gamma-linoleic acid, which is one of the omega-6s, which is high in things like borage and primrose oil, also helps with allergic symptoms. You also need to prevent angiogenesis, which is the production of extra blood cells or blood vessels to feed tumor sites. And what we know is that calcium accumulates at tumor sites, and calcium it constricts blood vessels, which is good for starving the tumors, but it's not good for everything else that happens in your body. So it always needs to be balanced with magnesium, because magnesium is a dilator. So you need to balance the two, and these also help to reduce blood pressure. If you have high blood pressure, potassium also for fluid balance. We're getting close to needing to take a break here. I'll do a little more, and then we're going to take a brief 30-second musical break. Too much calcium, incidentally, again, talking about balancing minerals, blocks zinc, which is important for immunity, among other things. Vitamin D improves the absorption of calcium, so you can take less calcium if you take vitamin D with it. We're going to need to a break for a brief, if I can get the attention of my... Yes, we're going to need to take a brief 30-second break here. When I come back, I'm going to continue on with a discussion of some of the other vitamins and minerals that are protective in a case of protecting you from cancer and other possible chronic illnesses. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I'm going to take a brief 30-second break and be right back. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman, doing a solo show on how to protect yourself from the development of chronic illness. And I've also been talking about the fact that the ways in which these things occur are extremely complicated. The causes are old. Most of it we don't even know. A lot of it is genetic. I'm going to talk for a little while longer about some of the nutrient therapies that work. What I'm really going over is that there's research from various sources about which vitamin nutrients and supplements have been shown to have an effect on preventing cancer from developing. So this would be something that you can use if you've been diagnosed or if you're just trying to prevent a diagnosis, which is prudent avoidance, or if there's a family history. And I was talking about all of the different minerals. Incidentally, I will open up the phone lines at about 2:40, and I'll give out the phone number at that point for you to participate. I was talking about the fact that you have to take your minerals in conjunction with each other for them to work efficiently because they affect each other. And vitamin C, we were talking about preventing what we're talking about is preventing angiogenesis, which is extra blood vessels that grow to feed tumors. Vitamin C and bioflavonoids taken together also, in high dosages, also stop angiogenesis, or has been shown in research to stop angiogenesis. And the protease inhibitors, which we find in genistein are in the isoflavones from soy, stop growth chemicals. We've heard about soy having things in it that help to prevent tumor growth. The thing to remember about soy is that there are also substances in soy that are anti-nutrients and that block mineral absorption. So you get a catch-22, but you can avoid this catch-22 by consuming soy that's fermented. Eating miso and eating tempeh instead of doing soy milk and tofu will help to protect you from ingesting too much. It also has a negative effect on the thyroid, which has a protective effect on your health all over the place. So fermented soy products give you better access to the protease inhibitors and the genisteins and don't interfere with your other, your thyroid and your mineral absorption. Blood thinners also stop the spread of cancer. So vitamin E, as we know, is a great blood thinner. Another thing that increases cellular energy, I might mention, is L-carnitine, very useful amino acid. Now, there are some nutrient therapies that have been shown to help chemotherapy work better. This is a dicey subject. Some doctors feel that if you take extra vitamins and minerals, that you're going to interfere with how well the chemotherapy works. So you do need to talk to your doctor about this, and there are sources of information that you can use. If you need to, you might need to get on the internet to find some of this. But some of the nutrient therapy that seems to help, that doesn't seem to interfere, is let me explain something first of all. What happens with chemotherapy is it causes malnutrition, and one of the things that they reported in the journal Tomori in 1995, they reported that tumors, this is a quote, tumors grow faster with poor nutrition. So chemotherapy reduces tumors, but it's also setting up a situation that can make you worse in the long run. So it's important then to support the body when you're doing chemo to balance that out. There was also a report in China's Journal of Cancer Institute in 83 that even using, as I mentioned before, weak multivitamins reduced cancer deaths. Now remember that cancer reduces all the antioxidants, among other things, but for nutrient therapy that can help chemo work, folic acid, which is one of the B vitamins that we've been reading a lot, is very important. All B vitamins are very important when you're doing chemotherapy. Bioflavonoids are very important. Fatty acids All of these things, folic acid, bioflavonoids, and fatty acids, all seem to stop drug resistance, which is important if you're being treated with chemotherapy. The genistein's from fermented soy, supports the anti-cancer drugs. Vitamin C and L-carnitine reduce the cardiac toxicity that can occur when people are being treated for cancer. Carnitine restores the heart rhythms. So, as I mentioned before, cancer reduces all your antioxidants, which protect the mitochondria from DNA mutations, which is part of what causes cancer. Vitamin E, CoQ10, and lipoic acid get through the cell wall, as I said earlier. Low vitamin C doses stimulated cell growth, while high doses inhibited tumor cells. But remember, vitamins work in concert, not individually. That report about the low doses of vitamin C versus the high is from Nutrition in Cancer in 1996, volume 26, page 11. Loss of appetite from chemotherapy is helped by taking all of the B vitamins. It also helps with bleeding and bruising. Another thing that helps with bleeding and bruising is vitamin C and bioflavonoids. What I was talking about before, anti-angiogenesis, prevention of development of abnormal blood vessels which feed tumors, again, vitamin C, bioflavonoid, also strengthens capillaries, preventing clotting, which is how metastases spread, is by getting caught on clots. The EFAs reduce inflammation. We talked about how important that is. More powerful than drugs is omega-3s. It's also one of the, reducing inflammation is one of the events in tumor development is inflammation. Remember that vegetable oils, especially corn oil, has been shown in studies to increase your chances of cancer. The main thing you want to know about vegetable oils is never eat them heated and always buy them organic and unrefined and keep them refrigerated. If you must fry foods, you use saturated fat, which does not change, but everything needs to be prevented from getting rancid. So protect your fats, because that's why they're implicated in high cancer rates, is because fat is so volatile and it gets damaged so easily. Quercetin, we mentioned before, histamine release. Calcium, vasoconstrictor, right, protects you from getting blood to the tumors. Has to be balanced with magnesium, vitamin D, so you can use less calcium. And remember over and over again, always with vitamins, take them in combination. One or two by themselves can be harmful in high-risk groups, and that's from the Center for Cancer Research at the University of Colorado. You know what? I've covered everything I needed to cover, so I think I will open up the phone lines a little bit earlier than usual and give you guys a chance to ask me questions or to share your own experiences with chronic illness, if you want to share them. The number in or out of the area code is 510-848-4425. Please turn your radio down before we pick you up so we don't get feedback. 510-848-4425. Who's our first caller? Ray in San Francisco.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. You know, something you just said reminded me. There were two things I wanted to ask you about in this connection, one with the rancidity and the other with aflatoxin, which is a product that's reported to be produced in peanuts that are improperly stored. Do you have two good rules of thumb for avoiding these two? The rancidity test, what would that be? And how would you know for sure that you're not encountering aflatoxin in your peanut products?
The way to avoid the best way to avoid it is if you want to eat peanut butter, which is where you usually find the mold that you're talking about. I'm giving out a brand name. There is a brand name. You can talk to your health food store. There is one brand that's very aggressive about testing for the mold and seems to have eliminated it from their peanut butter. So you might talk to your health food store and find out which brand that is. The way to avoid rancidity is when you shop at your stores, you may, if you're really concerned, when you're buying bulk, you really want to pay attention to how fast they change things over. You might want to smell things, you know, not stick your whole head into a bin, but smell. Remember that everything needs to be refrigerated.
And so do you think a sniff test is a reliable test?
No, I think that the real reliable test is that you get to know who you're buying things from and how careful they are.
Okay.
About
and then
stuff.
If you have oil out on the table, you should have small portions of it on the table and it should be kept in the fridge.
I keep it refrigerated, yeah. I mean, if you're just using it for the meal and you just have it out for a little while, yeah.
Yeah, so if something's delicate, like, say, an organically produced olive oil, would you leave it out more than a few hours at a time or more than
No, I would refrigerate it. That's just me, but if I tend to find out something like this and it's a thing I can do and it's not that hard, I do it. So.
Okay. Well, thank you for your responses.
Sure. Let's move on to Mary in Berkeley.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I eat a lot of raw sesame tahini. How I buy it in a jar. How likely is it to be rancid? And I have another question about tempeh.
So you want me to you're asking me about tahini. Tell me again. You're saying,
well, because it's high in fat, how likely is it that the fat is rancid?
Well, you know, it seems like I've suddenly sparked some kind of panic among my listeners here about rancidity. You know, with everything that goes on in the world, you just do the best you can. Mm-hmm. Again, what I said to Ray is that you want to kind of check in with your source and find out whether things are refrigerated before they're put out and how long they stay out, and buy things in smaller quantities, keep them in the fridge. You know, how you just use your... You're not going to kill yourself on the basis of eating a little bit of rancid fat. You just do the best you can by finding out who your source is and then refrigerating the rest of it when it's not in use.
Okay, thanks. While I was waiting to come on, I couldn't hear very well, so I think I missed that part of it.
Oh.
My other question is, I've just started eating tempeh, partly because of your show. I was eating a lot of tofu, and... Now, I understand this is cultured. Should it be cooked? And if you cook it, does it kill the culture? And do you need if it's something that can be killed, do you need it not to cook so that you can benefit from?
I'm not aware of there being a problem with cooking. I'm not an expert on tempeh, but my understanding is that it's intended to be eaten cooked. So.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's move on to Maria in Boulder Creek.
Yes, Raina.
Lena. Mm-hmm.
Lena, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
You made a comment about the calcium and magnesium relationship. I have not been able to clarify. I work with two different health care people, and they have competing interpretations. What can you say in terms of how many? I'm in my 70s, early 70s, and I need to take the calcium, but I know the calcium should be just before bedtime.
Well, the main thing you need to understand about it, and one of the reasons you're running into a problem, is what happens with information about nutrition. There are a couple things that happen. One is that the information gets out slowly. If you were very aggressive and you were always on the, not to say that, you know, everyone should be doing this, because I can't always keep up with it myself. I do the best I can, and this is what I do, you know. But even if you work very hard to keep up, there's a lag time between the information. Anyway, the basic thing is that if you study nutrient therapy, what you discover is that there are balancing effects to magnesium and calcium. And calcium taken alone, in if it's taken in excess, one of the reasons that cow's milk has gotten a bad rap among some people is, aside from the issues of whether there are hormones and things in it, is that there's so much calcium in cow's milk and very little magnesium. And what we've learned is that calcium in excess begins to accumulate in funny ways. Sometimes it goes where it's not meant to be or shouldn't be, or it could cause some problems. All of the problems are eliminated.
I have arthritis in my hand.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. All of these problems are eliminated when you balance it with magnesium, because magnesium has a similar but balancing effect. So like I said, calcium is a vasoconstrictor and magnesium is a vasodilator. The other thing is that in terms of bone protection, what we've discovered is that the magnesium balanced with the calcium is what protects the bone, not the calcium alone, because you'll start spilling calcium in certain circumstances. So, so you balance them. You take equal amounts.
All right. Now, my experience in looking at bottles...
Yeah, they're usually skewed in the direction of more calcium than magnesium, but you can always buy a separate magnesium product and take it with it. Remember that magnesium...
Now, can they be taken together?
Yes.
I thought calcium had to be taken alone.
No, I think you can take it together without causing a problem. And in fact, it's more likely that you won't. If you take magnesium alone, it can have a cathartic effect. So I found that people are different in terms of how well they tolerate it. But if there's a problem, you take them together. I don't think you'll run into any trouble.
Okay. So there are brands that actually combine them.
Yeah, and you can also buy extra magnesium and just add it to what you're taking.
Okay, and the proportion?
Equal.
Same amount?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's move on to Alfredo in Mountain View.
Hi. Love your program.
Oh, thank you.
I just wanted to pass a couple of things. I switched from peanut butter to almond spray it, and I found out that it's much better. It doesn't have the, I guess, the fungi or...
Yeah, it's true. Almonds are less moldy
right.
nut, yeah.
And the other thing that I wanted to mention is, I'm a vegan myself, but many times you talk about the subject of calcium, like you were just talking about to your previous caller, and I have read that there is a distinct difference between the type of calcium that you take and how that affects your body. I'm saying between calcium from cow's milk or calcium from vegetable sources, and I have read that there is a distinct difference in how these sources of calcium affect your body. And what I have read says that there is some suspicious of animal calcium with the loss of calcium bone mass in your body and so on. So could you comment a little bit more about that?
Well, I'm not one of the people that subscribes to the idea that animal protein or animal products cause calcium loss. The thing that usually causes calcium loss, in my experience, is that people are either eating too much protein at an individual sitting. In other words, one of the reasons that people who eat animal protein get a bad rap is that traditionally, in traditional cultures, sometimes, not in traditional cultures, but maybe in 20th century American culture, people started eating huge amounts of protein at a sitting, like an entire pound of meat or something. And you need to eat small amounts frequently throughout the day so that you're getting an even delivery of protein to balance everything else that goes on in your body and to repair things. But if you eat only less than 40 grams of protein a sitting, it doesn't contribute to this calcium loss. And in fact, when people don't eat enough protein, I think that it may contribute to some loss of bone mass. But basically, I think it's this business, again, of balancing the calcium with magnesium, balancing the protein and the carbohydrates, and eating amounts that are proportionate throughout the day instead of eating huge amounts at a sitting.
One of the things that I read is that if a person has osteoporosis, for example, one of the first things they should do is the most important thing is not taking calcium supplements, but to reduce the amount of protein.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you that I disagree right. with that because I've seen lots of studies that conflict with that. But anyway, I'm just telling you what I've observed in the literature and in my experience with people.
All right.
Okay.
Well, yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Alfredo. Let's move on to Dana in Hercules.
Hi. I came in the middle of your show, and you had mentioned that fermented soy was better than soy milk. My baby, I breastfed him, and now he only drinks soy milk because he's allergic to cow's milk.
Yeah.
Is there a problem with that?
I think it's possible that there is, and it's difficult to know what to suggest because you do need to use something in your formula, but...
Well, he's not taking formula. He drinks West Soy Plus.
Okay, yeah. But I have seen, I don't want to alarm you or frighten you, but I have seen studies that indicate that children who are given soy as a substitute for milk sometimes develop thyroid problems. And how to sort of balance this is difficult because, I mean, it would be nice if there was a liquid soy product that was fermented because that would help to alleviate the problem. But there isn't one. I'm not exactly sure what to recommend to you, but there is a book that you may want to look at that has information on this situation called Nourishing Traditions. The book is written by Sally Fallon, F-A-L-L-O-N, and it's published by ProMotion Press in San
Sally
Diego.
Sally Fallon?
Fallon, yeah.
Okay. Would you recommend him drinking then perhaps a rice milk versus soy?
It's a difficult problem. I'm not an expert on children.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't know exactly what to recommend to you as a substitute. I don't have a creative answer for that. I do know that, you know, rice milk is mostly starch, so it's processed starch. I'm not sure that it's going to... I mean, you do need to get minerals and things into him to help his bones. There is some calcium in soy. It may be just a question of doing some research and discovering what would balance the things in the soy that are a problem.
What would you recommend for vitamins for a 20-month-old?
Again, I'm not an expert in
would you say multivitamins?
Yes, certainly. And with children, you know, you want to make sure that they're vitamin rich. You want to make sure that they're taking enough. But yes, a pediatric formula of some sort that has that's hypoallergenic might be a good choice.
And I have one last question. We were recently exposed to a multitude of chemicals from a fire that we did not know staying in the house that hadn't been fixed. fiberglass. I don't know if it's what some asbestos, smoke, mold. And my concern right now is now that we do know, you know, I'm a little nuts. I like to, I have anxiety problems because I'm scared that some of that might have been cancerous. Is there any vitamins that you can take to...
Everything that I was telling you,
or to,
everything that I was discussing earlier is important. You want to make sure that you're taking fair amounts of all of the antioxidant vitamins, because the type of damage that you get from a chemical exposure is going to be sort of oxidative damage. So if you can add extra antioxidants, so A, E, and C, and balance them, everything that I talked about earlier in the show, all of those things, including probably some additional selenium in case there were some heavy metals in the smoke you were inhaling. Vitamin C is a very good detoxifier taken with bioflavonoids. But I kind of went over it in the show, and
yeah,
I don't want to
come
take...
in the middle of your
okay.
show. I do apologize.
Yeah.
And as far as my son was exposed to the same things, I know they do have droppers, so
yeah.
suggest the same type of
yeah.
multitude.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on to Elena.
Oh, hi. I have a specific question. Is there any group of vitamins that are better for brain tumors, let's say glioblastoma, considering that they are so vascularized?
That's a pretty complex question, because usually the types of things that people take for brain function increase blood flow. So you're asking me something that's a very specialized sort of situation where you need to reduce the blood flow to the tumor. My guess is that the same sorts of things that reduce angiogenesis in cancer would help, and that again was both calcium and calcium and magnesium, and then also taking vitamin C in high doses with bioflavonoids.
All right. And, for example, the soya that you were talking about with miso and tempeh, could that be also work because of the growth factors?
Well, do you know whether or not you're dealing with a tumor that is a carcinogenic tumor?
Well, you know, it's a glioblastoma multiforme. So it's kind of the most aggressive brain tumor. And it can grow very fast.
Yes. Eating things with genistein in them certainly won't harm you, so it might be an extra thing to add in. Is this something you're dealing with personally?
Right. Essentially, he's a friend of mine.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I'm really sorry. I think the other thing to do is just all of the good things that you know in terms of being kind and being supportive and taking time out, all the other things I was talking about as well. But yes, I think that... all of the things that I mentioned that are good for cancer help with avoiding tumor growth, too. So all of it will help with this.
And also, for example, some low dose of aspirin?
I wouldn't necessarily suggest that. I'd rather see people use vitamin E,
right.
You know, 800 milligrams. But remember that in a situation like this, nobody is suggesting that taking vitamins and nutrients is a substitute for doing anything that Western medicine knows
right.
to reduce that tumor. So these things are meant to support the body while you're doing other things, and then we hope will make an effect. So I wish you a lot of good luck with all of that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Chris in Palo Alto.
Hi, Elena. Boy, lots of things here. I wanted to make a comment on calcium magnesium. I think you answered the questions quite well before. I know we're not supposed to do advertising on the air, but let's put it this way. One of the reasons why people get conflicting information about what they should do about their calcium magnesium status is they're looking at results of lab tests that are irrelevant. Either they're looking at hair or they're looking at blood, and nobody knows how to interpret a high level of calcium in the blood, for example, which might actually indicate a very high level of osteoporosis and a need for increased intake of magnesium, for example, or reduction of an acidic diet. But anyway, maybe...
Well, there's another thing, too, which is that blood tests for mineral and vitamin levels are not very effective at giving you a sense of what's available to the tissues.
That's
in fact, if you get an abnormal test from your blood, it usually means that you're in critical you're in a critical situation. So those things are not usually very valuable.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it may have more to do with things like your adrenal function and stuff like that.
Correct. So there is actually one example of the literature, and I don't have the reference handy, of a person who had been found to had extremely high levels of calcium in the blood. And the diagnostic by a very good physician was actually that she was excreting calcium and leaching calcium out of her bones because of high acidity and high phosphorus content. But, you know, the average physician would have seen this high calcium level in the...
Well, you see this in urine and stuff.
Anyway, in this case, it was in the blood.
Okay.
Anyway, what I wanted to say is that as far as I am concerned, the most reliable test for evaluating tissue levels of calcium and magnesium is a test that's given by a lab in Northern California called Intracellular Diagnostic. And I'm not affiliated with them, and most doctors who are very familiar with this field will know.
Yeah, there are certain kinds of blood tests that are specifically designed to give you these results.
This actually is a scraping under the tongue, not a very rough scraping, and it just basically has been designed for NASA, originally for the cosmonauts.
Okay.
To this day, the most reliable test.
All right.
So that's one I would recommend. It's very inexpensive. It's non-invasive. And it's extremely reliable.
Okay.
And one last thing about people.
Yeah, quickly, because we're running out of time, and I've got
people who get exposed to toxins. I think they, especially in the case of this woman with a young child, they might consider a homeopathic detoxification.
Yeah, I was just thinking that's a good idea. There's also chelation therapy, but chelation therapy gets into a whole other thing, you know, because it can cause some disruptions and, you know, it's hard on the kidneys and stuff. But
and it's expensive.
It's very expensive.
But anyway,
homeopathic remedies, sometimes if you're working with a homeopath, some homeopaths are aware of this and others don't work this way, so.
Right, I know. We're talking non-classical homeopathy.
Exactly.
I will mention another company, and it's called Apex. And
okay.
It's only with doctors and health professionals.
Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh, bye. Let's move on to Dave in L.A.
Yes, hello, Lena. I have a question. I actually came down with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma about a year and a half ago.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, well, it's all right now, actually.
Good.
And I had surgery and removed a dead tumor and went through 6 months of chemo and radiation and all that and had my first post-treatment scan, and everything is clear, and I want to know if there was any way you would alter what you the list of things that you said in terms of people who've actually gone through this and are now on the other side of chemo and radiation and have the depleted systems that seem to be part of this process, and any way that you would alter what you said for people that have actually are on the other side of it now and
well,
are trying to prevent recurrence.
Yeah. One thing I would add is that your diet, your actual, you already know that you have to eat whole foods because they work, you know, the whole foods have all kinds of synergistic enzymes and things that are in there. Not necessarily raw foods, but whole foods. And my experience working with people is, and not everybody agrees with this, and also from my experience looking at research, I really think that people who are recovering need a little extra protein. And I don't agree that there's been studies that, for me, are convincing that animal protein in small quantities, clean animal protein from organic sources, is dangerous or promotes a tumor. And in fact, when people are recovering, it's absolutely critical that they get enough protein for repair, which is what protein's for.
Do you think that game meat would be, I have access to...
Well, you can, sure. I mean, that's going to be your cleanest thing. But ironically, if